Hi, I'm Kyoko. I'm from Japan. Listening to the world is one of my morning routines. The world helps broaden my horizons. I really love listening to the world. Thank you.
If you are like Kyoko and the world is part of your daily routine, we hope you'll join her in donating today. Listener support is crucial for our show. It allows us to bring you the best in international reporting with our mix of rigor and empathy. You can visit theworld.org/give to donate. That's theworld.org/give. Every bit helps and will get us closer to our goal of raising $25,000 by June 14th. Thank you so much. Hey there, I've got a quick favor to ask you. We are doing a listener survey to learn more about how you listen, what you like about our show, and maybe what we could improve on. It takes about 2 minutes to fill out, and we would be grateful if you did. You can find that survey at survey.prx.org/world. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. Thank you. A U.S. military officer working on Middle East policy quit his job after he came to this conclusion.
The U.S. government was never going to seriously put the brakes on the Israeli operation.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also, in India, the votes have been counted and Narendra Modi gets another 5-year term as prime minister.
The result is not only surprising, but also a bit of a paradox.
That's because the winners are frustrated and some of the losers are actually celebrating.
We'll also hear about President Biden's new immigration restrictions and today's anniversary of the deadly crackdown in Tiananmen Square.
Plus, cold beet soup stirs emotions between two Baltic countries.
Lithuania, step back. It's Latvia's game. This cold beet soup, we're claiming the fame.
All coming up today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us. We start today in the Middle East, where Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is facing new pressure to accept a ceasefire plan put forward by President Joe Biden. One of Netanyahu's coalition parties came out in support of the prospective deal aimed at ending the fighting and freeing the remaining Israeli hostages in Gaza.
U.S. National Security spokesperson John Kirby told ABC this week that Biden's plan is a good deal. He said it would roll out in phases.
Phase one would allow for some hostages, the elderly, sick, women hostages, to get out over a period of 6 weeks. No fighting, more humanitarian assistance in. And while that's all going on, the two sides would sit down and try to negotiate what phase two could look like and when that could begin.
Netanyahu has said that the fighting can only end when Israel has defeated Hamas. Two of his far-right coalition partners have also threatened to quit the government if any ceasefire deal is approved. Former U.S. diplomat Robert Silverman, speaking with Israel's I-24 News, says the Israelis have signaled a willingness to sign off on a temporary truce.
I think the Israeli deal is a short-term ceasefire and release of hostages, no commitment to a permanent ceasefire. I think the real story is that Hamas has already rejected this deal because they are demanding upfront a permanent ceasefire before there's any release of hostages. No Israeli government will accept that.
In an interview that came out today in Time magazine, President Biden implied that Israel's prime minister might be extending the war in Gaza for political reasons. For months, Netanyahu's critics say he has dodged questions about a post-war strategy for the Gaza Strip.
Let's turn now to the story of a U.S. military officer who has resigned in protest of the Biden administration's support for Israel's war in Gaza. Army Major Harrison Mann served in the military for 13 years and until yesterday worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency specializing in the Middle East.
I think I, for better or for worse, had a front row seat to everything that was happening in Gaza.
Mann submitted a request to resign last November, citing what he called unqualified U.S. support for Israel that he says has enabled the killing of Palestinian civilians.
The U.S. support that me and my colleagues were definitely going to be a part of was going to be unwavering and essentially unlimited.
Harrison Mann was not free to discuss his decision until he left active duty yesterday. This is his first radio interview about his resignation. I asked him to describe the moment when he decided that he could no longer, in good conscience, continue with his job.
If you recall back to mid-October, I think October 17th, There was a lot of attention around a explosion at the Al-Ahli hospital in Gaza that killed 100 plus Palestinians. You know, there were conflicting accusations of who was responsible, and the intelligence community put a lot of effort into investigating this event. And in the end, they determined that it was not Israel. It was a Palestinian militant group. When we correctly assessed that it was not the Israelis, everybody kind of patted themselves on the back. And like, that was the last time that we ever looked into Israelis bombing hospitals, even though in less disputed instances, they bombed several Palestinian hospitals that same month. And so I kind of lost hope that normally controversial or legally questionable acts like bombing hospitals were going to be something that we objected to on the U.S. side, and realized that the U.S. government was never going to seriously put the brakes on the Israeli operation.
You are Jewish. You describe in your resignation letter how you were raised in an environment that emphasized the importance of never again and the inadequacy of just following orders. Can you tell me more about how your upbringing influenced your decision to resign back in November?
Yeah, I'm Ashkenazi Jewish, European descent Jew. Most of my family originated in Eastern Europe at some point. You know, the Jewish experience as they understood it was that Jews were this victimized people in Europe, this unwanted population that was really tormented by whoever had the power to do so. And I think everybody with my kind of background in the States grows up with that understanding, which is accurate. You know, that was not my experience growing up in the States. I felt very confident and safe being Jewish. You know, years later, I find myself in this job, and there is another unwanted, marginalized people who is also suffering greatly. And the people who are imposing that suffering or contributing to it was me and my colleagues and the people I work with helping make this happen. And that was a very difficult realization to come to and to admit to myself. And it's very hard to live with now.
Yeah.
But that revelation is what drove a lot of my decision making, and it's in part what's driving me to keep speaking out about this now.
In your letter describing the reasons behind your resignation, you talk about shame and guilt. What were you doing in your job that you felt shameful or guilty about?
I did not have a very important or glamorous job, but I was part of the machine that was directly involved in supporting the Israeli military. It's not hard for me to tie some of my actions a couple steps down the chain reaction to stuff that happened in Gaza.
What happened to you after you resigned and described why you were leaving?
I was very afraid about what the reaction was going to be, which is why it took me so long to be honest about it with the people that I worked with. But the response was overwhelmingly positive and supportive from the people that I worked with. The day after I sent my letter to about 100 people who I worked with at the agency, about 15 reached back out, and the general energy was gratitude and that they were happy that somebody had finally said something and that they, you know, felt similarly and didn't feel comfortable talking about it and thought that they were alone too until I messaged.
Did you also get pushback from within the military or even in your private life?
Very little. A very limited number of people, I think, responded with anything that was not agreement. And someone told me, hey, I really don't agree with the position that you took, but I respect that you put yourself out there and spoke out about this. There were a lot of people waiting to hear somebody talk about this. And I'm sure there's many folks who disagreed with me or disagree with the way that I went about expressing my concerns, but they did not generally feel strong enough to bring that up with me.
I'm speaking with U.S. Army Major Harrison Mann, who resigned from the Defense Intelligence Agency in protest of what he calls Washington's unqualified support for Israel. I wonder how much debate there is among U.S. policymakers on the inside about American policy with regard to Israel and the war in Gaza. Is there a lot of contentious discussion about the role that the U.S. is playing?
I worked below the National Security Council policymaker level, but I will just say, in the institutions that I'm a part of, you know, which was the intelligence community, Department of Defense, and the uniformed military, we consider ourselves professionals who do not discuss contentious topics, do not discuss politics, or in this case, do not discuss highly politicized topics. So I think despite clearly a large number of people feeling the same way that I did, I don't think in any of these spaces there's really widespread kind of open discussion or debate about the merits of our support for this war, the same way that you see maybe in the State Department, where they have a lot more open discussion and dissent cables and means like that.
Right. You're referencing the State Department has an internal dissent channel for people to share their honest opinions. Is there anything like that in the Pentagon?
Not that I'm aware of.
What do you hope to accomplish by resigning in this very public way?
You know, I ultimately want the at least plurality or large number of people inside the national security and military workforce who are contributing to the mass killing in Gaza and know that it's wrong to understand that they are not alone and to try and make them feel empowered to try and do more than nothing about it. I felt alone. I felt powerless. I discovered a lot of other people feel that way, but I want folks out there who are in my position, first of all, to understand kind of the hard truth that, you know, if you feel like what you're doing is wrong, I don't think anybody else is going to pop out and tell you it's time to stop. Because I waited for that moment for a very long time, and it did not happen. I hope I'm proven wrong, but I don't expect it. But, you know, with that, I want everyone to understand that it is not too late to behave in a way that you can look back on and be proud of.
Major Mann, Israeli leaders say that they are going after Hamas to make Israel more secure. The stated mission of Hamas is to eradicate the state of Israel. And of course, there were the horrific attacks on October 7th that kicked off this violence. What would you have Israel do differently to be waging this war in a way that you would feel more comfortable with?
If you look at this conflict purely from the perspective of what is best for the Israeli people, which is not the government that I worked for, to be clear, you would see that they have made themselves incredibly less safe with their conduct of the war, which has now spread to, I think, 5 or 6 countries, many of them shooting projectiles or trying to shoot projectiles into Israel. I think if the Israeli military had visibly actually been targeting Hamas leadership, and if they had stated a realistic and achievable goal for their operation, it would be much easier to support, and it would be much better for Israel in terms of not drawing all of the international condemnation and isolation that they've achieved from this operation. If your goal is to defeat an organization whose ideology is hating Israel, bombing everyone's grandma is probably not the best way to do it.
Major Mann, I can hear that you're speaking very carefully, choosing your words very carefully, and maybe that's just the way you always speak, but I'm wondering if you are nervous about speaking out about this or, you know, are very carefully choosing how you talk about this.
Yeah, I think I would really like to reach a broad group of people, especially people who consider themselves national security professionals. There's a lot of conversation over whether or not this is a genocide, and that goes into legalistic arguments that I'm not really qualified to evaluate. I feel I am qualified to make an assessment that it is wrong to help kill and starve tens of thousands of children, which is something that I can say that I did, and something that my friends and former colleagues are still being asked to do.
U.S. Army Major Harrison Mann resigned from the Defense Intelligence Agency to protest U.S. support for Israel in its war in Gaza. His request to resign went into effect yesterday. He spoke with us from Washington.
The world's reporting on the war between Hamas and Israel continues online, where you can hear perspectives from across the Middle East and around the globe. That's at theworld.org and wherever you listen to podcasts. Coming up on the show, it was not a landslide, but Narendra Modi has claimed victory in India's elections. What it means for the world's most populous country, that's just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Narendra Modi has declared victory in India's national election.
Bharat Mata Ki!
Yes.
Bharat Mata Ki!
Yes.
Bande!
Modi there shouting victory for India and praise Mother India. The win pushes him into a historic third term as prime minister. But Modi's party did not deliver the landslide that some expected. The narrower victory is likely to have an impact on the way Modi governs over the next 5 years. Reporter Sushmita Pathak is in Delhi and has been following the election results.
I was talking to political commentator Rashid Kidwai, and he said the result is not only surprising, but also a bit of a paradox.
Those who have, won are feeling a sense of loss. And those who are, going to be in opposition, feel vindicated.
The winners feel a sense of loss and the losers are happy. Modi's party, the BJP, were expecting a much bigger victory, a landslide. But if there was any disappointment, it didn't come through in Modi's victory speech.
Hum sabhi janta janardan ke bahut aabhari hain.
He thanked Indian voters for placing their faith in his party. Now, Modi himself had said that his party and his allies would win more than 400 of the 543 seats. That did not happen. Modi and his allies do have the majority, but the margin is much slimmer this time. On the other hand, the opposition alliance has exceeded expectations. This is a group of over two dozen smaller parties led by the Indian National Congress. That's the party that used to dominate Indian politics before Modi. They didn't get enough votes to win in this election, but it's enough to celebrate.
Regional differences in the vote amongst this large population in India can reveal a lot. What are some of the noteworthy trends that are emerging in this vote?
The most noteworthy result came from Uttar Pradesh. This is a state in northern India. It's the largest state in the country. It has the most number of seats. And the BJP struggled there. This is in the Hindi-speaking region, which is supposed to be at the heart of BJP's Hindu nationalist base. The BJP also couldn't get enough traction in the state of Tamil Nadu. This is a state which he desperately wanted to win. It's a manufacturing hub in southern India, and Modi had held several rallies there. In the end, his party didn't win even a single seat. It's kind of humbling for the BJP. Also, it looks like many rural voters turned against Modi. Farmer distress and unemployment are big concerns, and that's being reflected in the result, I guess.
Yeah, so that's interesting. What can we expect now, Sushmita, as Prime Minister Modi prepares to begin this historic third term in power?
Right. Modi is set to become the Prime Minister for a third consecutive time. But Rashid Kidwai says his brand image will suffer.
He would not have that kind of that same sheen and aura that he had before 4th of June 2024.
The BJP will have to form a coalition government. And that's a first for Modi. Kidwai says Modi will also have to brace for a much louder opposition going forward. They'll be more aggressive in parliament. And Modi and his party will have a harder time getting new legislation passed.
So not the breathing room Modi has had in the past. Now, this was a lengthy election process. Remind us, Sushmita, how long Indians have been waiting to know the outcome.
This election seemed to go on forever. It was held over seven phases. Some 640 million people came out to vote. That's a world record. But it was also a very grueling election, Marco, because of the heat. Several states in India have been seeing temperatures above 110 degrees Fahrenheit, even close to 120 in some places. And voters had to go out and stand in line in this kind of heat to cast their ballot. On one particularly hot day, 33 poll workers died. The agency that conducts the polls has said that in hindsight, polling should not have been planned during the peak of the summer. Of course, now it's too little, too late.
33 poll workers dying of heat. That is a tragedy at several levels. And from what I understand, they are not the only victims of this heat wave in India, right?
Right, right. That's what I'll be covering this week. It feels very dystopian, this heat wave.
Be safe, Sushmita. We'll be listening for that report, and thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on the show, Marco.
Sushmita Pathak reports for The World from Delhi, India.
Summer is on its way. In the U.S., that often means watermelon, corn on the cob, or homegrown tomatoes on the table. In the Baltics, it's the season of cold beet soup. Over the weekend, Vilnius, the Lithuanian capital, hosted the Pink Soup Festival. Leading up to it, Lithuania made a provocative claim that its version of the specialty is better than Latvia's. The World's Daniel Offman reports on how those fighting words are being received in the Latvian capital of Riga.
Pink Soup Festival is only in its second year, but it's already a popular event across Vilnius. This year, more than 1,000 people sat at one table the length of 4 football fields to eat the soup together. They beat spoons against their bowls in anticipation, and later they set a record for most people eating pink soup at the same time. Go Vilnius, the city's tourism agency, hyped up the festival on social media with trendy videos introducing foreigners to the country's favorite summer soup.
It's pink soup season.
If you've never had pink soup before, you have not lived. It consists of beetroot, kefir, cucumber, dill, and some spring onions. Everything either gets grated or chopped up really finely, so it's really easy to eat.
Leading up to the festival, the agency turned up the heat, so to speak, proclaiming on Instagram that the Lithuanian soup was better than Latvia's. Both countries claim the dish as their own. But according to Gintare Kavalunente, who's with Go Vilnius, there's one main difference in how they eat it. Lithuanians serve it with a side of boiled potatoes. Latvians eat it with bread.
For Lithuanians, this is really a strange way to eat pink soup. And we are saying, no, you never eat pink soup with bread. You only eat it with hot boiled potatoes.
In Latvia, Madara Oga, who's with Riga's tourism agency, says there's a simple explanation for how they eat their soup.
Latvians eat rye bread with everything, so bread is our potatoes in this case.
Olga says there are a few other key differences. Latvians use marinated beets, whereas Lithuanians use boiled beets, and Latvians add mustard and horseradish. As the two Baltic countries began trading barbs, Riga's tourism agency doubled down, turning the skirmish into an all-out beef. Lithuania, step back. It's Latvia's game. This cold beet soup, we're claiming the fame. Pink soup from Latvia, get it through your head. Lithuania, the rapper is wearing hot pink from head to toe. She's also making it rain with fresh dill.
Man, they gotta be tripping.
Is this a joke or what?
I don't even know. Is she serious?
It feels like an international conflict, you know?
This might not be Drake versus Kendrick, but Lithuania soon responded with its own diss track. In the soup, we sail, we swim, we sink. If you cut us open, we will bleed pink. At the end of the day, just about everyone in the Baltics bleeds pink. Here's Gintare Kavalunente from Vilnius again.
The truth is that this soup is loved all over our region, starting with Lithuania, Latvia, Poland. We just enjoy the love and passion that this soup gets from all the region.
Madra Oga from Riga agrees, and she admits that her team is envious of the Pink Soup Festival. But she's still sticking to her guns. She says that Latvia's soup is better. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman, Riga, Latvia.
More global news and stories are coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. June 4th, 1989, after a bloody crackdown in Beijing, the Chinese government made a deal with the public.
If you take political change off the table, your life will get better in material terms and you'll get more kind of personal freedoms.
How that bargain is holding up 35 years after the Tiananmen massacre. Still ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Iran, today was the deadline for candidates to register for the country's upcoming presidential election. Dozens of hopefuls have entered the race, including the former Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He was disqualified in the last round of elections, but as The World's Shirin Jafari reports, he is throwing his hat in the ring once again.
Iran was supposed to hold the presidential election next June, but the sudden death of the country's president, Ebrahim Raisi, in a helicopter crash last month, upended those plans. Over the weekend, surrounded by a sea of reporters, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad registered his name for the race.
Yeah.
with a big smile on his face, he held up his birth certificate. This has a lot of significance, he said, in an apparent jab at another candidate who is said to have been born in Iraq, not Iran. Ahmadinejad was president from 2005 to 2013. His two terms were filled with controversies. His re-election in 2009 was met with mass protests that became known as the Green Movement. Iranians believed the election was rigged and their votes were stolen. During his term, Ahmadinejad questioned the Holocaust and made homophobic comments.
There's not much difference between Donald Trump and Ahmadinejad.
Sina Azadi teaches international affairs at the George Washington University.
They're tapping on the same fears of the people. They tap on nationalism.
Azadi says Ahmadinejad famously praised Cyrus the Great, a pre-Islamic king of Persia, instead of religious figures. The conservatives inside Iran were furious, he says.
He is extremely proud of his modest background, emphasizing that his father was a blacksmith. And that's why people from humble backgrounds understand him and like him.
The former president is one of 80 people who have registered to run. It's now up to the Guardian Council to vet and approve candidates that it considers fit. Ali Vaez, director of the Iran Project at the International Crisis Group, says other prominent figures are also running. People like former and current speakers of the parliament and the former nuclear negotiator, Saeed Jalili. He says the question now is who goes to the next round.
If it's a more pluralistic list of candidates, then it suggests that the system has understood that there must be a balance between competence and loyalty. And if that's not the case, then it will appear that the system neither cares about participation rate nor about competence, but only about predictability at the top of the political system ahead of the looming transition.
The looming transition Vaez is referring to is the replacement of Iran's supreme leader. He's 85 years old and suffers from health problems. He's the top decision maker inside Iran and the religious leader for millions of Shias across the world.
The reason the Islamic Republic cared about political and ideological conformity at the top rather than legitimacy from the bottom is that it wants to ensure that the transition to the next supreme leader occurs as seamlessly as possible.
The next president plays a crucial role in this transition, Vaez adds. Ahmadinejad is unlikely to be approved. He even hinted at this when speaking with reporters over the weekend. I have joined the race despite all the problems and challenges that lie ahead, he said. While Ahmadinejad basks in the limelight once again, politicians like Jalal Jalilzadeh say they haven't been allowed to register. The former representative from the northwest of Iran told the BBC that he wasn't permitted to add his name. Jalalzadeh is Sunni, and he complained that minorities like him are expected to vote in elections but rarely permitted to participate as candidates. The Guardian Council will announce the final list of names on June 11th, and the election will be held on June 28th. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
Early this morning, China's lunar lander blasted off the far side of the moon, carrying rock and soil samples it collected there. The Chinese Space Agency hailed the mission a success, saying the probe was able to pick up some surface samples and that it also drilled down beneath the lunar surface. The far side of the moon is far less explored than the near side we see from here on Earth. China's spacecraft planted a flag on the spot it took off from.
And remember back in April when five military horses got spooked, broke loose from Buckingham Palace and bolted through the streets of London? Well, three of them have returned to their official duties. They will likely take part in King Charles III's birthday parade this month. The two other horses injured in that escape are still recovering, officials said today, but they should also be back at work soon.
And finally, some news that maybe soccer fans did not miss. Soccer superstar Kylian Mbappe says today it's a dream come true to be officially playing for Real Madrid. The French forward has been called a once-in-a-generation talent, but his 7 years with the club Paris Saint-Germain came to a somewhat difficult end. The financial details that brought Mbappe to Madrid have not been disclosed.
Find more news online at theworld.org.
In much of the Gaza Strip, the medical system is no longer functioning. Since the start of the war last October, it's been very hard for Palestinians to leave Gaza for treatment elsewhere. And for a month, it's been nearly impossible. That's since the Israeli military took control of the Rafah border crossing with Egypt. Yesterday, we introduced you to Mariam Farajala. She's a 6-year-old Palestinian who lost her right leg in an Israeli airstrike and then needed medical care abroad. Here's the world's Duri Buscarin with part two of Mariam's story.
There are things that 6-year-old Mariam Farajala remembers about the Israeli bombing that she survived, but her family did not. She remembers the name of each hospital they moved to, trying to find a place that could take her. And then there are things that her 19-year-old aunt, Fatima Farajala, only talks about when Mariam isn't listening.
I think
how the hospital they went to was completely overwhelmed, how there was no anesthesia available. So when doctors had to amputate Mariam's leg at the hip, she was awake. Farajala says the doctors told the family that it would be a miracle if Mariam survived. To stabilize her, Farajala knew she had to get her out of Gaza. For most of this war, there has been one way out of Gaza, the Rafah crossing into Egypt. It is no longer taking medical evacuations while under the control of the Israeli military. But before that, every Palestinian who wanted to leave had to get their name on the list, a series of names published every day of Palestinians who were approved to leave the Strip.
Every person I have tried to evacuate, adult, I have failed.
Tanya Haj Hassan is a Canadian pediatrician who volunteered at Al-Aqsa Hospital, one of the places that Mariam was treated. She says multiple adult patients who she tried to evacuate died before they could get out, like a young mother who opened a can that she thought was a food ration but was an unexploded mine.
She had stayed alive for about 3 weeks in excruciating pain with extensive burns all over her body. A patient like that needs a burns unit.
A unit that Al-Aqsa does not have. Haj Hassan says that in the middle of all this, children are often the only patients who can get out of Gaza in a medical evacuation. You can also get out of Gaza by paying a private company with ties to Egyptian intelligence. That can cost up to $10,000 a person. But everyone still has to get a security clearance by both the Israeli and Egyptian authorities.
There's people that are waiting that have been cleared for months, 5 months, 6 months, and they can't get out.
Tarek Haylat is a 28-year-old medical student. In between classes in South Carolina, he helps coordinate medical evacuations for children for a small nonprofit, the Palestinian Children's Relief Fund, which submitted Mariam's case for approval.
It's really sad, honestly, because they're depending on you and they're messaging me day and night, pull us out, what's going on, why are we not being pulled out?
Every day that a patient waits matters, Haylat says, especially for an amputation like Mariam's, which has a high risk of infection that can spread to other parts of a child's body. A staggering number of those injured in this war have been children, says Dr. Andrea Moscatelli, a pediatrician who helped organize medical evacuations for the Italian government. 40% of Gaza's population is under the age of 14.
Most of their injuries is because of collapsing buildings or explosions, so fragments of the bombs. Fractures, amputations, spinal injuries, and burns.
After receiving security approvals, patients' names are published around 10 p.m. on a Facebook page run by Gaza's General Authority for Crossings and Borders, a government agency controlled by Hamas.
So the problem is that in Gaza, there is no electricity, the cell phones are not working, so it was very difficult for them to understand if they had the permission to leave.
The injured child and one parent have to get to the border crossing the next day and endure a process which can take 6 hours, Moscatelli says.
And in some way, it was selecting the most stable patients.
But the list doesn't go out anymore. On May 7th, the Israeli military took over the Rafah border crossing. They claimed it was being used for terrorist purposes. According to the government of Gaza, 11,000 injured people are still waiting to leave the Strip for medical care. 6-year-old Mariam was lucky. She says she remembers leaving Gaza. She says she felt exhausted, as if she couldn't go on. Mariam and Fatima Farjala were taken to a hospital in Egypt, where the 6-year-old had another operation. But it was only the beginning of what was to be a long recovery in Doha, Qatar. But on the flight, Fatima Farjala says that Mariam woke up screaming. She insisted that her little brother, who died in Gaza, was sitting in the seat next to her. Farjala fears that the trauma of who Mariam has lost will follow her, no matter where she goes in life. For the world, I'm Derry Bouscarin. Doha, Qatar.
The Biden administration unveiled a sweeping executive order today on immigration. It's designed to limit the number of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border. The move will temporarily halt asylum requests. And here is where it gets a bit complicated. The pause will kick in whenever the daily average of border crossings outside of official ports of entry tops 2,500 people. Right now, about 3,700 people enter the U.S. from Mexico this way each day. Immigrant rights advocates and others are already threatening a legal fight against Biden's executive order. That includes Lee Gelernt. He's deputy director of the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project. We spoke with him just before the full text was released.
What it does is block people from applying for asylum based on where they enter. And what Congress has done has been very specific that no matter where you enter, including whether or not at a port, you must be allowed to apply for asylum. And that's consistent with international law. And what Congress has recognized is not everyone can get to a port of entry because a cartel may push them through between ports. They may not know where the port is. They may be traveling with a small child and can't walk hundreds of miles to the port. So what Congress has said very clearly is if you get to U.S. soil, we will screen you for asylum. It doesn't mean everyone gets asylum, but we will at least get a screening. This stops even the screening. So we could have people who are in grave, grave danger based on their religious views, their political views, not even getting a screening for asylum.
There are some exceptions to the shutdown, though, right? Some populations are excluded.
We are hearing that they will exempt unaccompanied minors. And while we obviously are in favor of unaccompanied minors getting that treatment, what I think is going to happen is an unintended consequence is that what we saw previously when they exempted unaccompanied minors at prior bans is that families have to make a cruel decision. Do they send their child alone, put them in danger, have to live alone in a strange country, or do they keep the child with them in what may be serious, serious danger in their home country or in Mexico? And so I think what we're going to see is forced self-separation of parents and children.
So what is your understanding of what happens when that 2,500-person limit is reached on a given day?
Yeah, again, with the caveat that we'll need to review the exact language, our understanding is that when the cap is reached, you will not be able to apply for asylum unless you fit into a very, very narrow exception that I think virtually no one will fit into.
In the past, President Biden has said he doesn't necessarily have the authority to block asylum seekers at the border. This is him talking to Univision about a month ago.
There's no guarantee that I have that power all by myself without legislation. And some have suggested I should just go ahead and try it. And if I get shut down by the court, I get shut down by the court. But we're trying to work through that right now.
Lee, where does this new presidential authority then come from?
Biden administration is claiming that they have presidential authority and regulatory authority to do this. I think as President Biden acknowledged, we do not believe that authority exists. President Trump tried the same authorities and we successfully challenged it. And I think that's why the Biden administration is acknowledging that they may likely not have this authority. I mean, they will argue that this has slight differences with the Trump administration's policy, because the Trump administration didn't have a particular cap. We view those as legally irrelevant. And I think the Biden administration's expecting a lawsuit, rightfully.
The Biden administration is saying that they need to pass something on the border because the legislation that they were trying to get through earlier in the administration's term was not put forward, and they need to do something. What do you think is a better alternative if your organization plans to oppose this executive order?
So what we would like to see is more resource at the border. Screening's happening much quicker. If you have a credible asylum claim, you're allowed in the country. If you don't, then you're going to be removed. That's unfortunate. I think we also need to have more pathways for people to get in the country to work. I think everyone acknowledges, as I understand it, every economist, that workers are needed. But because we have so few pathways for people to come, everyone's lining up at the border trying to get asylum. Asylum seekers really aren't trying to evade law enforcement anymore. Families are coming and sitting down right over the border, waiting for an agent to approach them so they can apply for asylum. So what we need is more screeners of the asylum claims rather than more enforcement. So there are ways to do this, but they're not quick-term fixes. They require money. And I think both parties are struggling to find the political will to actually roll up their sleeves and do something serious rather than these quick fixes that may sound good in sound bites.
But it's been clear that that is very hard to make happen. And, you know, we're in an election year. So what's the practical alternative?
Policy is ultimately not going to deter people from showing up at the border. When people are that desperate, they're going to come no matter what. Their lives are in danger. They're going to come. And so for those people who have legitimate claims, we need to screen them. If they don't have claims, there's already the law in place to remove them very quickly.
Lee Gallant is the deputy director of the Immigrants' Rights Project at the ACLU, which opposes the executive order on immigration that was announced today.
Reflections on 35 years since the Tiananmen Square massacre in China. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. In China, today, June 4th, is one of the most politically sensitive dates on the calendar. 35 years ago today, soldiers from the People's Liberation Army turned their guns on protesters in Beijing, bringing a bloody end to weeks of pro-democracy protests in Tiananmen Square. The Chinese government does not tolerate any attempt to call attention to those events in 1989.
For many years, people in Hong Kong were able to hold commemorations and vigils around June 4th, but not since the government in Beijing has been cracking down on most forms of free expression in Hong Kong. Jeffrey Wasserstrom teaches modern Chinese history at the University of California, Irvine. He talked us through why this date is so taboo in China.
Initially, it's important to note that the Chinese Communist Party had a story to tell about it, that they talked about it at first. They presented it as riots that had gotten out of control, that then soldiers had come in to restore order. And so initially, they thought they could sort of sell that idea. And then over time, it just wasn't working. There were too many people who had other experiences of knowing that the protests on the whole were very nonviolent and were not trying to overthrow the Communist Party, but simply get it to live up to its own professed ideals and things like that. So they shifted toward trying to repress discussion of it.
So fundamentally, what did the protesters at Tiananmen Square want that the Chinese government was so dead set against and seemingly is still in opposition to today?
So there were a lot of things the protesters wanted. They were frustrated by official corruption, which is still something that's an issue in China. They wanted more political freedoms, but they also just wanted more personal freedoms. There was a sense, especially among students about at that time, that the government was micromanaging their kind of daily life, controlling what kind of music they could listen to, interfering with who they could date. And so there was a way in which these frustrations about both daily life things and broader political things and frustration at corruption and nepotism, they just all fused together.
Mm. Of course, 1989 is more than a generation ago. What is your sense, Jeff, about how the events of June 4th are understood today in China?
So there are people, there are all kinds of different people who get different access to different information. And so there are actually a lot of internationally minded, you know, savvy people. It's a small percentage of the population, but it's a significant number who can go over the Great Firewall and find out information about other places, or they travel abroad and they know a good deal about what happened in 1989. And they have a range of views about that. So it's not as though there's never been a complete amnesia. And you also do see, there also isn't an end to resistance within China. There have been protests since Tiananmen on all sorts of issues involving workers, involving students at times and others. What the government's managed to do, though, is allow some of that to take place, but stamp down really hard on anything that looks like it connects people from different social groups and from different parts of the country.
Well, how much do you think the current government needs to worry about any sort of real anti-Communist Party popular movement gaining traction in China?
Well, they had these white paper protests a couple years ago that I think took them by surprise. People held up blank pieces of paper as a way of kind of mocking the government's hyper control, saying, we've got all sorts of grievances. We'll just hold up a blank piece of paper because, you know, are you going to try to tell us we can't even express that? I think one of the things to know about that is, as I suggested, there was this kind of unspoken deal, which was like, if you take political change off the table, your life will get better in material terms and you'll get more kind of personal freedoms. Well, a couple of years ago, what started to happen was the economic boom times were stopping. And then with COVID lockdowns, that kind of notion of allowing more personal freedoms was gone. So you could see why, in a sense, there was a sense that that deal just wasn't working.
For decades, people in Hong Kong would commemorate the events of June 4th, 1989. How did that actually come about?
So in Hong Kong, people never really bought the idea that there was anything justified about the crackdown at all. And so there were protests commemorating June 4th, the day of the massacre in Hong Kong, ever since 1989. And there was a real question after 1997, when it became part of the People's Republic of China, would it have to play by the same rules about there being tight control on commemoration? And there was a promise that Hong Kong would be able to go largely its own way under something called One Country, Two Systems. It would be part of the PRC, but have a set of freedoms. And the vigils on June 4th became a kind of test case and a way of people in Hong Kong saying, this is a way of expressing the fact that we really do live by different rules here.
So if Hong Kong is no longer a place where people have the freedom to critically look at the crackdown at Tiananmen Square, where does this happen in the world? I mean, is it happening with the Chinese diaspora now in new ways?
It's always happened to some extent with the diaspora from the mainland, but now diaspora and exiles from Hong Kong are playing particularly active roles in it. And there have long been vigils in Taiwan also with a very special kind of meaning. Taiwan's another place where there was intense interest in the Tiananmen protests in 1989, and there stayed intense interest in it. And by the way, after Tiananmen, though Tiananmen was crushed, the next year there were protests in Taiwan that helped bring about democratization there, and in some ways were partly inspired by Tiananmen, and the authorities in Taiwan didn't want to be seen as being as crudely draconian as the mainland. So Tiananmen played a role, not the only role, but it played a role in the democratization of Taiwan. And Taiwan's another place where there have always been commemorations.
Yeah, in that context, Jeff, why do you think this day, June 4th, is still important to remember?
Even though the Tiananmen movement was crushed, it inspired people in Hong Kong that, you know, you can't have a story of what the protests that happened there in later times without looking back to 89. It inspired some people in Taiwan, as I mentioned. It also inspired people in Eastern and Central Europe. Rationally, you'd think that seeing the tanks in Beijing in 1989 would make people fearful about going out onto the streets against another communist party. When people in places like East Germany protested in the fall, some of them feared there would be something like what happened in Beijing. And East German leaders even talked about carrying out a quote-unquote Chinese solution. But they also felt inspired, like if people in China could show their bravery this way, maybe we should have the guts to stand up, even though it seems potentially impossible thing, even though events like this have been crushed before. So I think there are a lot of reasons to look back to it, even though it ended so tragically.
Jeffrey Wasserstrom teaches modern Chinese history at UC Irvine. His latest book is Vigil, Hong Kong on the Brink.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us right back here tomorrow.
Before we say goodbye, I'm popping in to remind you that The World is fundraising now through June 14th. We'd appreciate it if you'd consider making a recurring gift today to keep our nonprofit newsroom running. You can head to theworld.org/give to donate and learn more. That is theworld.org/give. Thanks so much.